Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Terly Frequency.
Yes, welcome to the start of your weekend right here on Archangel Radio. And this Friday, we are talking faith, food, and firmament. On the show today, we have Bob Carlton from AL.com talking food. We have Rob Herbst, the Catholic Week editor, who will be dropping in later to bring us up to date on all things faith happening across the Archdiocese of Mobile. And our main guest today, we are joined by the Vatican's Observatories, Brother Guy Consolmano, who will be talking all things celestial in the next segment. Top of the hour, we will look beyond the heavens to heaven itself when we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to be part of that. Feel free to send us your prayer request by texting us on 251-928-2111. Lines are open right now. So how does all that sound? Think you can handle it? Well, good. So let's get this show on the road. Hello and welcome to the Terly Frequency with me, your host, Kevin Turley. This final installment of the Terly Frequency this week. And what an installment we have. It's absolutely packed to the rafters with guests talking about all the things that really matter and some things that perhaps we didn't know mattered as much, one of which is food. I don't know about you, but this Lent, all I can think about is food. And on Fridays in particular, when we're not eating meat, I start to think about nothing else but steaks and burgers and sausages and all the good stuff. So what can I do? Well, if I can't have any meat to eat, I may as well be talking about it. So we have looked up our good friend Bob Carlton at AL.com, senior features writer there, to talk about all things food, in particular fish, during this holy season of Lent. Bob, good morning to you.
Hey, Kevin. We're getting him on right now. Give us just a minute.
Okay, well, while we're waiting on Bob, many of you will know Bob's writings from AL.com. He writes about all sorts of good things, but he seems to write an awful lot about food. I envy the man, if that's his job, going around sampling the cuisine across the state of Alabama, because certainly if the photographs are anything to go by, it looks pretty good. And also what strikes me is the variety of the type of food that is available across Alabama. We're just trying to hook up now with Bob, get him on his phone. He's probably in the middle of his breakfast. That's probably what he's doing because he's a food writer. He has to sample the cuisine sometime. Anyway, one story in particular caught my eye, which I want to talk to Bob about, which was about all these Irish pubs and restaurants across Alabama, which he was waxing lyrical on. And in particular, I wanted to talk about some that may be in the Fairhope Mobile area, because as you know, St. Patrick's Day is on the horizon. And I wanted to know, well, to give that great Irish feast, that great Irish festival, a certain Alabaman spin would be very, very interesting.
Hey, so, Kevin, I believe that we have him now. So,
Bob, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. We're kind of waiting on storms to arrive up here at our way. I think y'all are good down there, aren't you?
I'm sure we are. I hope all is well, Bob. I hope that you're going to be safe and sound. But listen, I was just saying before you came on air that your articles, many of which are about food, and I have to say they're wonderfully illustrated, are an absolute torture in this season of Lent when we Catholics are not eating meat, especially meat on Fridays. So talk to me a little bit about fish, fish fries in particular. What do you know about this fish fry phenomena that happens across Alabama around this time?
Well, I mean, you know, I just think it's a way for people who are observing Lent to have, you know, Fish Fridays. To be honest with you, I don't off the top of my head know how that tradition began. But, you know, a lot of people who observe Lent, you know, have meatless Fridays and they eat fish and instead of having beef or pork or chicken, and they you know, you have a lot of the restaurants will have fried catfish, you know, fried seafood, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Which
so I was looking down at some of the restaurants you were recommending, Bob. If I was coming to Alabama and heading towards Mobile and Fairhope, where would be the fish restaurants for this time of year for somebody who's given up the meat? Where would you say that this will make you not miss the meat? This fish is so good in this restaurant, you're going to be okay.
I'm looking at my Mobile dish, I mean, list right now, and you know, there's a great, it's more of a high-end restaurant, but there's a great restaurant in Mobile, Bob Baumhauer, famous Birmingham restaurateur, has a restaurant called Dolphins. It's at the top of the RSA building in downtown Mobile. It's got a beautiful, spectacular view of Mobile, and you can see all the, it looks out over Mobile Bay, so you can see all the waters where the fish came from. So, and he has everything from crawfish cakes to crab claws and grilled dolphin. So he's got kind of the bounty of the sea there. So, and then I guess a blue collar end of the spectrum is a classic Mobile restaurant. I think it's recognized as Mobile's oldest restaurant, the Dew Drop Inn. I think it's over on Old Shell Road, and they have it sounds rather unique or rather different, but they have something they call like a crab meat omelet. They're famous for their hot dogs, but they also have really spectacular omelets, and they have a crab meat omelet. So that's a little something different for your Fish Friday, but that's a great place. And
Bob, keep going.
Oh, and then I was just going to suggest the Lighthouse Restaurant, which is in a small little town called Irvington, which is in northern or southern Mobile County. It's called they have a chicken and oyster gumbo that one of my colleagues, David Holloway, who's a great food writer down there, he raves about their chicken and oyster gumbo. So those are three right off kind of off the top of my head. So.
Well, that sounds like pretty good recommendations to me. Now, the other thing that caught my eye, Bob, on the AL.com was a few references to Irish-themed restaurants or even Irish-owned restaurants in Mobile, Fairhope, and also across Alabama. Because, as you know, St. Patrick's Day is on the horizon. And being an Irishman, I take a keen interest in all things Irish across the Atlantic. Where would you recommend the Sons of Erin to go in the Fairhope, Mobile area to find the old sod in culinary terms?
Well, there's the most famous Irish pub in Mobile is Callahan's Irish Pub. Mm-hmm. I think they block the streets off down there on St. Patrick's Day, which is what, coming up in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great kind of a neighborhood institution in Mobile, called Callahan's Irish Pub. That'd be a great one.
And what sort of food could we look forward to in your average Irish pub, bar, restaurant in Alabama? What sort of things keep occurring?
Well, you know, you have like stuff like bangers and mash, and then you have, you know, Irish stew and some of those traditional Irish dishes. And then, you know, it being America and it being Southern, a lot of them have great burgers too. In fact, Callahan is famous for its bacon cheeseburger. It's probably as famous for its burger as it is its Irish food. So, those are some things.
And what about this? Also, we're moving into spring, and I noticed that you had an article about ice cream and iconic Alabama ice cream going away. What's happening with this? Is it Trowbridge's?
Yeah, it's up in Florence in North Alabama. It opened in, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a little over 100 years, but they are famous for an unusual flavor called orange pineapple. And, you know, it's a real, obviously from the name, it's a real citrusy, sweet citrusy, almost like a sorbet. But the problem is their supplier, Mayfield Dairies, you know, it's an iconic flavor for that place, but it's not a real popular seller elsewhere. So the supplier discontinued it. So they are working with a creamery in Tennessee who is taking their recipe and going to develop the flavor. So they're hoping to have it back and serving it again within a month or so. So it's going away, but it's coming back. So,
right. Well, Bob, you are a sort of penance for us on a Friday, because you come on and you talk about all this wonderful food that we're supposed to be giving up one way or another, be it steaks, ice cream, burgers, or whatever. But we really enjoy listening to you talking about all the culinary delights in Alabama. Apologies if we interrupted your breakfast, but we'll allow you to go back and finish it now. And thanks very much for coming on the show, Bob.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good to chat with y'all.
That was Bob Carlton from AL.com talking to us about all the culinary delights across Alabama, which I know, it's a bit of a torture at this time of year during Lent, but what can we do? We still have to eat. And Sundays are not Lent, remember. Sundays you can go out and have your burger, have your steak, have your ice cream, whatever you want. Sundays are not Lent. That's as far as I know. Now, but I must admit that these Irish pubs and restaurants in Alabama do look very interesting. If you happen to be listening and you know anybody who runs these pubs or restaurants or frequents them and you know a very good one, why don't you phone in the next few days or weeks to recommend where people can go to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, especially on this show, which, as you know, is an Irish-themed show every day because I'm on it. So 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. Now, I realized last night that I had forgotten to finish off my story time because do you remember I told you that I was going to tell you about St. David and how he was linked to a place in England, but I'd also said that he was linked to Elvis Presley. Do you remember? And I never quite finished that. So maybe, I can do it now, or maybe it's story time later today. I will bring you up to date on that. Oh, it'll have to be later because we have a call. Reed, who have we got? Where are they from? Or are we still on the automated system?
I have not figured out yet, Kevin. We just got off the call with Mr. Carlton, so I wasn't able to screen it. But I'll just put you through to them.
Absolutely. Let's take it. Who are you? Where are you calling from? And you are very welcome on the Turley Frequency.
Hi, Kevin. It's Kristen. How are you?
Oh, hi, Kristen. Hey, good morning to you. You're in California, right? Up bright and early today, Kristen.
I am. I'm getting ready. Oh my God. I've got some great news. Oh my God. You're going to love this. Okay. So I took, who was the guy that gave me the suggestion in your studio? about doing some like central casting about.
Mike. I think it was Mike gave you that advice, was it?
Yeah.
Our producer, Mike.
Yeah. Right. So I took his suggestion and I went down to the central casting. Oh my God, Kevin, I've got a part. Ah, I got a part in a movie. It's a horror movie.
Really?
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yes, yes. And I'm on the set right now and it's starting really early in the morning, which I don't like. I've already had like 2 cups of coffee. I'm like, I'm jonesing. Anyway, so I got a new part and I just want
Whoa, Kirsten, too much information coming at me too quickly. What? First of all, what's the name of the movie?
It's something about a werewolf. Like London Werewolf or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like he comes to like California. And he, like, kills people. And then he goes to London and, like, kills some more. And anyway, so I play, one of the girls, like, the victims that he kills. And I've got a speaking part, Kevin.
Really? Are you, like, one of the chief characters in the story?
No, it's like a really small part, but like I have a few lines. Like, you want to hear them? Can I run them by you?
Sure. Yeah. Let's go. Let's go. What are your lines?
Oh my God! Really? You don't let me do this over the air?
Come on! It's live radio, Kirsten. Anything goes.
Oh,
just let it out.
You're giving us
a sneak preview, okay, folks. If you're listening, Kirsten has a role in a movie.
Okay.
It's a werewolf movie. We don't know the title, but there's werewolves in it, so it must be good, right?
Right. Okay, so here we go. Oh my God. That's so gross. Get away from me, you creep. I don't know. I think he's a werewolf. Oh my gosh, he's so hairy. Yeah, he's definitely a werewolf. What do you think, Kevin?
Wow. That's pretty good. That's pretty. I thought for a moment there, you know, that was real, Kirsten. That was pretty good. Yeah, I mean,
really?
But tell me this, Kirsten. Are you a victim of the werewolf, or do you fight him off? Or are you one of the people that conquers the werewolf? How does it work?
Well, like at first, like he starts to like court me. I don't know. He's a werewolf. And then, like, we go out on a date, and then he gets really mad, and he, like, starts growing hair and, like, turns into the werewolf. And then he comes after me, and then I have to, like, oh, my God, I can just do a scream, Kevin. Like, ah, he's coming after me. Help me.
Oh, that's great, Kirsten.
Please,
but wait a minute, Kirsten. The last time we talked, you'd got a job in a lumberyard. What happened there?
Oh, that was horrible. Oh, my God. That was so bad. Okay, so they're, like, teaching me how to cut wood, and I got a splinter. I was like, I can't do this. I'm going to get splinters, and it's going to hurt, and I'm just, it's gross. Like, I don't like working with wood, Kevin. And so I just told the HR person, I'm like, this isn't going to work out for me. Can I wear gloves? And they're like, no, like, you have to learn, you know, to be tough. And I'm like, no, okay, this is 2023. People wear gloves when they work with wood. So, and I saw somebody got cut. Oh my God, he got his finger cut off. And I was like, that's so gross. I was like, you know what? I can't take this. I'm not doing this anymore. I can't handle this. So I quit. And I took, you know, the guy in the studio, his suggestion about central casting, and mm-hmm. I just went for it, and I'm so thankful, and I just want to thank him. Is he there?
Yes, he is here. Mike, are you listening to this? Your career's advice has come up trumps.
Yeah, I am, Kristen, I am so, so, so elated for you. I'm glad you took my suggestion there, and was able to get a part, and now you sound great. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you so much. I really couldn't have done it without you. What was your name again?
Hey, it's Mike Romano. So if you want to toss my name out there, I'll take a part.
Oh, really?
Mike does a very good werewolf, Kirsten.
Yeah, I'll come up there. I'll fly out there and play the werewolf number two. You know, the assistant werewolf.
That's right.
Oh, my God, this is so cool. Like, y'all can, like, gang up and they'd be like, you know, one goes to the West Coast. I'll talk to the director about that.
Well, no, listen, Kirsten, forget, you know, it's more important that you beef up your part. You know what I mean? I mean, try to convince them that there's hidden depth to your characters. It's, you know, it's not just a kind of scream and that's it. There's psychological depth to this character, and maybe help the script along. You never know. Directors are always open to suggestions, as I've found on film sets. But this is great news, Kirsten. We're so proud of you. Keep us up to date on the progress. What happens next as the werewolves of London approach you out in California? That's wonderful. When we come back, we're going to be crossing to Arizona, and we will be speaking to the director of the Vatican Observatory. That's right. It's all planetary this week on the Turley Frequency. Stay tuned. To the Turley Frequency with me, your host Kevin Turley, coming to you live from London this Friday morning. Aren't you glad it's Friday? I'm sure you are. And we are thinking heavenly thoughts. Now, I was looking at the Psalms the other day, and I came across Psalm, 91, verse 1. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. So says the psalmist. However, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I look at the stars, it's not the vastness of the universe that I find myself contemplating as much as how small this world feels in comparison. So how do the heavens tell of the glory of God? And for Catholics, what are the benefits to studying the science of astronomy? Well, to help me with this, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Brother Guy Consolmano, who is the director of the Vatican Observatory. He is also president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation, with a particular area of research in the ever-topical subject matter of asteroids and meteoroids. And Brother Guy joins me down the line this morning. Brother Guy, welcome to the Turley Frequency here on planet Earth.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Brother Guy, you probably heard that intro just now, and I'm one of those people that kind of understands the vastness of the universe and has a sense of wonder about it, but knows precious little about it. And my question to you would be, if I knew more about the wonders of the universe in terms of astronomy, etc., would that help my Catholic faith?
I believe so. You really get to know a creator by getting to know the things that that person has created, from whether it's the pictures that you have in your refrigerator of your favorite niece and nephew, to understanding Shakespeare by reading Shakespeare's plays. God could have created the universe any of an infinite number of ways, and he chose to do it this way. And I think that tells you something about his creation. It's a place where he and you can get together and play together in an intimate way. I'm reminded of when I was a little kid, and I would play cards with my mom. And I'm wondering, you know, mom can win the game anytime. She's not playing the cards to win. She's playing cards as a way to have some time with a child she loves. And God gives us this universe as a place where we can play with him.
That's a beautiful image, Brother Guy, and it's very, very helpful in a sense of God having given us this wonderful universe to play in. However, you will have heard this many times, I'm sure. There are many out there, many who are not Catholics, and even some Catholics, who say that science contradicts faith, and that people of science are not people of faith. Now, I know this is old hat for you, but how do you counter those type of discussions that you must get at every single dinner party you go to?
Oh, yeah. You sort of wonder, where did that come from? Since science was invented at the universities that the church founded, so many great scientists were deep people of faith, from, you know, going back to Albert the Great, who, you know, was the one who taught theology to Thomas Aquinas, but also was a great scientist, to George Lemaître, who, you know, invented the Big Bang Theory, or Gregor Mendel, who came up with genetics. In the face of all of this evidence that it's not true, where does it come from that people keep pushing this idea? And usually you find they've got an agenda, and then you try to find out what is their agenda. But at the end of the day, I just like to tell people my religion tells me that God made the universe, and my science tells me how he did it.
Now, you're a very interesting man. I was looking at your biography earlier, Brother Guy, and it'd be fair to say you were a late vocation to the Jesuit order. And you had been a scientist beforehand.
Yeah, I was an early vocation in a sense because I was thinking of being a Jesuit and prayed about it, and God said, no, not now, not yet. And that's when I went off to become a scientist instead. So it was 20 years later that I entered.
Well, that's the bit that interests me, Brother Guy, because it's not that you went from a Catholic school or whatever, a Catholic home, to a religious order, and that was that. But you went in and in some depth into the world of science, and yet you ended up a Jesuit brother. I mean, was that deep dive into science, did that confirm your faith in any way?
It certainly ran parallel to it. I was growing up then. And I was growing up as a scientist, and I was growing up as a person of faith. I think those years were really important to me. I wasn't ready to be a Jesuit when I was 18. I still had too many ideas of what it meant to, you know the truth. Too many people go into science thinking that science is all about finding the truth, when really science is about coming up with ever better questions. You know, if we ever came up with the final truth, there'd be nothing left to do. And then, you know, I couldn't ask for more money to be a scientist. And it's the same way with religion. It's not just learning what's in the Bible. It's not just memorizing the catechism. It's then living it. And in the living, you discover, oh, that's what they meant. Oh, that's what I really need to do. And so both of them grew together. It's hard to tell really which one helped the other more because they're so intertwined in my life.
That's wonderful that you're able to say that. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the wise words of Brother Guy Consolmanu, who is the director of the Vatican Observatory out in Arizona, but he's many other things as well, an expert on asteroids and meteoroids. Answer me this, Brother Guy. I always wondered, you know, when people talk about the Vatican Observatory, I always think of Italy, and yet it's out in Arizona. How did that come about?
Well, we are still in the Vatican. The Vatican is a different country from Italy. We're very, very sensitive about that.
Yes, true.
So, and one of the reasons the observatory existed was to show that the Holy See is a state independent of Italy. So we still have our headquarters in the Pope's Summer Gardens. We still have our meteorite labs where I work half the year. We still have some telescopes and a lot of programs that happen there. But light pollution is the thing that drove us first out of the center of Rome to the Pope's summer home, and that was in the 1930s. And then in the 1980s, the light pollution made it impossible to do astronomy from there. So we had friends here at the University of Arizona, and they offered us a place to come. And so we collaborate closely with the University of Arizona, which is one of the great astronomy departments in the world. And they've got telescopes all around us here in Tucson. So we built a telescope with the university on one of the mountaintops. And now we've got half a dozen people working here, half a dozen people in Rome, and migratory birds back and forth. But it's an interesting thing about light pollution. I just want to make this point. Pope Benedict, in a homily on Easter Saturday night, talking about light and dark, made the comment almost off the top of his head saying, you know, we create lights in our cities that blind us to God's lights. Mm-hmm. And isn't that a perfect image of what sin is all about? Which I turn the other way around and saying light pollution is a terrible sin, which it is.
No, you're absolutely right, Brother Guy. And we had somebody on from Birmingham University here in Alabama, and they as a sideline, they're very interested in trying the campaign against light pollution. And the quote from Pope Benedict came up, absolutely. And it really stunned me that Pope Benedict had talked about this, about light pollution. But also, if you just think the Psalms I was quoting at the start, if the heavens do proclaim the glory of God, then the sort of blocking out of those heavens is a way of sort of diminishing the great awe, the great sense of wonder that we have at the Creator, would you say?
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. I'll steal that. I'll use that the next time I give a talk.
You can use it all you want, Brother Guy. Now, listen, if you have a question for Brother Guy, and there are going to be the inevitable questions, Brother Guy, I warn you. But if you have a question, do feel free to text me. I'll happily put your questions, Brother Guy, on 251-928-2111. Or call in and speak to the director of the Vatican Observatory on 888-928-0881. Brother Guy, before we move to some of the more obvious questions, which again, you're probably slightly bored answering, and I get that. I mean, do you think that in my lifetime, you know, in the last sort of 50 years or so, do you think there's been a sort of dumbing down of science in the public realm, that people aren't as scientifically adept as they were maybe in previous generations?
In some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. Because I think, you know, I've been around now 70 years. I was a kid 50 years ago learning this. And I think there was a lot more naivete among scientists, among the general public. They may have known more facts about science, but they had an unbridled respect. Science won the war. It was kind of the way we were taught, you know, because we were still in the echoes of World War II. It really wasn't science. It was technology, and they couldn't tell the difference. I think there is a skepticism to science now, which hurts you if you don't appreciate what science is, but which is good if you think that science is the infallible answer to religion, because it's not. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I've really seen in the last 50 years is I look at what my predecessors at the Vatican Observatory were writing and saying and speaking, and they were up against people in the scientific world who thought you had to be an atheist to be a scientist. That's not the case anymore. That you don't find that. Maybe a few biologists still think that, but most scientists now are very comfortable with dealing with people of faith, with having faith themselves, and I find it's much more accepting than it was 50 years ago.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think there's a whole tranche of scientists now who have come to faith of some sort because of the wonder of their own scientific inquiry. We have a question for you, Brother Guy. I'm afraid it's the obvious one. You know what it is, yep. Don't you? What are Brother Guy's thoughts about life on other planets?
I would love to find it. You know, I wrote a whole book with my good buddy Paul Muller, with the title, Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? ?
That's right.
And then the subtitle and all the other crazy questions people ask us. I think they made us take the word crazy out. But it's a great question because it makes you suddenly want to ask yourself, what does it mean to be baptized? What does it mean to be life? Mm-hmm. There was a time when we were infants and the universe was us. And eventually every infant discovers another infant. And it's this marvelous moment where, on the one hand, they're not the universe anymore, but on the other hand, they've got a friend. I think if we were ever able to find other life elsewhere in the universe, it would be a moment like that. It would be a moment where it would shake us a little bit, but it would also excite us because we've got new people who look at the universe and maybe even look at God in a way that we couldn't. Now, have we found it? No. We haven't even found bacteria on another planet yet. And that would be the more exciting thing from the scientific point of view, because we don't really know what life is. We only got the one example, so we don't know what's common to all life and what's special to just life here on Earth. We won't know that until we find bacteria at other places. So, yeah, one step at a time.
I don't know if you've come across the recently published Extraterrestrials in the Catholic Church by Paul Thigpen.
That one, no. There's a number of books on the topic that have been out there, and it's great speculation as long as you don't take it too seriously. You know, it's science fiction, and I love science fiction, but science fiction is fun. It's meant to stretch your mind, not to give you answers.
I totally agree. I think Paul Thigpen's book, though, is interesting because he's researched it really from, I mean, he has the Church Fathers, Origen and various others mm-hmm. quoting about life on other planets. So, sure. Well, listen, we're just going to take a short break, Brother Guy, if that's okay with you, mm-hmm. and then we'll come back. We've got lots more questions, lots more coming in, people wanting all sorts of things, which you know they're going to ask you about. So, listen, if you've got a question, feel free to text it in on 251-928-2111. So stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. We'll be back straight after these words. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency, live and exclusive here on Archangel Radio. And I'm having a fascinating discussion this morning with Brother Guy Consolmanu, who, amongst many other things, is director of the Vatican Observatory, which, as we've been hearing, has an observatory out in Arizona, but also one in Vatican City. Brother Guy, when you were coming on this morning, there was a question I wanted to ask you, but I hesitated. I thought, Brother Guy will think I'm crazy if I ask this question. Do you mind if I ask you?
Well, I already know you're crazy, so it's too late. Go ahead.
Well, a number of years ago, I came across some writing about the Martian satellite moon called Phobos.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked into it, and all sorts of strange things were being suggested about Phobos. You probably know what I'm talking about. There were some suggestions, I think, from a Russian astrophysicist that it was somehow created by beings of some sort. And this got as far as a letter that went to the President of the United States, President Eisenhower. You probably know all this, and I hear your laughter, which means that it's complete and utter bunkum, as we would say, this side of the Atlantic. Or is it? Tell me.
Well, it is. But back in the 50s, we knew nothing. And it was as reasonable as anything else back then. Now, these moons are fascinating because they seem to be moving in their orbit, one of them coming closer to Mars and the other further away, and their densities seem to be low. At first, you know, people might think, oh, well, they're artificial. But now we've got images of them. We've had mm-hmm. satellites going around Mars with wonderful cameras for the last 30 years. And you see that they're very rocky, but they're piles of sand. Now, think if you take a bucket to the beach and you fill the bucket with sand, you can fill another half bucket of water and pour that into the bucket. You know, the sand only takes up 50% of the volume. And that's the case with these moons. They're not solid rocks like people once thought. They're mm-hmm. piles of rubble, and particularly loose piles of rubble. Which is right. fascinating. Now, the other question is, where did they come from?
Mm.
And this tells you something about how science works. And you read things in a book and you think, oh, they figured it out. No, they think they figured it out. But I work half the year in Europe, and everybody in Europe knows that the material that makes up the moons of Mars is material that was splashed off the surface of Mars and reformed itself into a moon. And then I come to America, and everybody knows that the moons of Mars were captured asteroids from the asteroid belt. And both sides are so used to thinking the way they think that they have a hard time thinking it could be anything else. But it changes the way you design the experiments you make. If you're going to build a spacecraft to go to these things, if you're going to try to measure what they are in a telescope, the assumptions you make about it change the questions you ask. And I find that's fascinating because we don't even know the assumptions we make at times. So that's why, you know, you see you've got lots of people coming in with questions for me. Questions are great. Questions are what science is all about because questions make you start thinking. And you shouldn't be satisfied with any one answer because there could be more than one answer. And we don't know yet, which is true.
So, I mean, it's interesting you say that because I think the whole mythology around Phobos wasn't helped by Arthur C. Clarke, Stanley Kubrick, and science fiction. Would you say that science fiction, especially popular science fiction, the stuff that really gets into a culture, is mm-hmm. is often more of a hindrance to a real scientific understanding of the universe, say?
Oh, no, no. If you do it right, science fiction is can excite the imagination, especially for young people, because the science you need to be able to understand the planets, really, you need graduate-level physics and very deep mathematics and a lot of stuff that most people don't have access to. But if you tell a story, then you can live in that story and get a sense at least of what it must be like to live there and be there.
Right.
Stories are a great way of doing this. And you know who is really good at teaching using stories rather than highfalutin words? Jesus.
I know.
In the parables. So in a sense, science fiction are parables about the universe.
What's your favorite science fiction movie?
Oh, my. Well, now you're getting into the really deep theological questions. I think I will pass and merely say that there are some movies out there that are wonderful that I really like. I'm certainly a Star Wars fan. And there are some movies out there that are incredibly terrible, and I like them even more.
Good answer. Okay, some of these questions. What is the best way for people to learn about astronomy and study the stars as amateurs? So somebody's texted that in.
I recommend a book. This is the book mm-hmm. that I got when I was 10 years old, and it's mm-hmm. still in print. And it's called The Stars, and it teaches you the constellations, but then it also teaches you how the sky moves and how the stars in the sky move. And as I say, it was written so a 10-year-old could understand it, because the author was H.A. Rey, R-E-Y, and he's the same guy who wrote the Curious George books.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got these marvelous illustrations, just like you get out of Curious George, but they're books that you can use if you're in high school or if you're an adult. Because to me, the temptation is to go on the internet and see beautiful pictures from Hubble, and that's great. Nothing wrong with that. And you mm-hmm. go to Astronomy Picture of the Day, that's marvelous. But never forget the fact that you can walk outside and look up at the sky, and that's what they're talking about. Just as you could learn a lot of theology, but if you never pray, then what's the point?
That's true. So true. Another question. What do astronomers do besides look at the stars?
We spend 1 week looking at the stars and 6 months trying to figure out what we were looking at and then go on to how can we explain it to other people. Because the funny thing is, astronomy, you know, I do it by myself in front of a computer or looking at the image that comes from the telescope. But I do it as part of a community. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you realize astronomy isn't the study of stars and planets. Astronomy is the study of what other people are saying about stars and planets. So you go to meetings to hear what their ideas are, and that excites new ideas for you. And you go to meetings to tell them what you've come up with, because the feedback, the excitement that they have from hearing from you is what then gives you the energy to go back and do the tedious work that you have to do day to day to be an astronomer. So it's this community. It's writing. I mean, if there's anybody in high school right now who's listening, who thinks they want to go into science, what do you learn in high school? How to write. Your English classes are as important, maybe even more important, than your math classes, because you have to be able to express what you've seen and understand what other people are saying when they've written down what they've seen. This communication, this part of a community, is mm-hmm. really what makes science happen. And once again, I draw the connection with the church. You can pray all you want by yourself, but if you don't have a community of fellow believers, then you're missing out on all the fun.
Absolutely, and that's the whole point of it. I mean, you know the famous quote from St. Thomas More, you go to hell on your own, but you only go to heaven with other people. Brother Guy, talk to us about this observatory. I mean, is there a sense of community there? I mean, how does the day run at the Vatican Observatory? Is there a fixed time for prayer, or how does it work out?
Yeah, we are a Jesuit community, which means we all mm-hmm. live under the same rule with the same superior, and
sure.
what little money the Vatican sends to us, we can pool that and live pretty good. There are a dozen of us, and we all have our own scientific research, our own scientific field, ranging from cosmology and the Big Bang up to asteroids and cosmic dust, and stellar populations, galaxy and galaxy evolution, lots of different things in astronomy. Mm-hmm. But most of us, I mean, for myself, I tend to get up about 6:30 in the morning, mm-hmm. and I'll be, I'm living in the community. I'm the guy, I'm the director. I'm also the guy who takes the garbage out. You know, it's part mm-hmm. of living in the community. I'll be at my desk in Rome early because I've got emails that came all during the night from the U.S. and vice versa because of the time difference. At 10 o'clock, the first religious moment is when we all leave our offices and gather in the coffee room. And Luigi or Francesco makes cappuccinos for us. Very important. It. But it's a time when we see each other and, you know, find out what's going on in each other's lives. Mm-hmm. At about 20 past 1, we gather again in the chapel for the midday prayer. Now, Jesuits were not obliged to pray, but we're certainly encouraged to pray as a community. Obviously, we pray individually.
Sure.
And when we can, we pray as a community. In Rome, the big meal of the day is at 1:30, and there's a local woman who comes in and cooks for us and does a great job. So after that, I tend to take a nap afterwards. Big Italian meal with the local wine, you definitely want a nap. But about 5 o'clock, I'll be up. I'll go into the Pope's gardens for an hour to walk and to pray mm-hmm. and just, you know, put everything in a perspective and talk to God and listen to what God wants me to hear and see. Maybe by 6, I'm on Zoom calls back to America. At 7 o'clock, we gather together as a community for the daily mass. And then at 7:30, we, as a community, empty the dishwasher, have some leftovers, and maybe once a week get together and just chat about what's going on in the world. But a lot of the times we're back in our offices, you know, 8 or 9 in the evening because we're zooming back to the United States.
Sure. It's funny that, because I would have thought astronomers were sort of night birds, that they would be up at night with the telescope into their eye and they'd be peering across the universe. But it's not probably quite like that with computer systems these days, is it?
Well, not only that, but the telescope here in Arizona is a good 4-hour drive from where we actually live. So
right.
One person at a time takes the Jeep, goes up the mountain. It's a really tough road to get there.
Mm.
And then they will be up all night collecting the data in a really intensive, I've got 5 days, I've got 7 days, this is my chance, hope the weather works. All the data is now on computer disks or sent over the internet back to your computer in Tucson. You come down the mountain, and now you've got months of work pouring over the data you took, cleaning it
right.
up, pulling out the noise and the signal, and wondering how this fits into what you expected to see, and does this inspire new things for you to look at? So that's the time when you work on it. The rest of the year, you do spend a week up all night, but the rest of the time, you're there during the day.
Well, what's it like on those nights when you're alone up there on the mountain, looking into the stars?
It is very much like being on retreat. It is very much a monastic life. And there's a certain beautiful rhythm to it. The actual act of taking the data, for the most part, is pretty simple. You know what you're doing. You type in some numbers. You push a button. The computer does the work for 5 minutes. And while you're waiting for the image to be taken, maybe you'll be reading a book. Maybe you'll be listening to music. Maybe you'll be praying. And then the computer beeps, and you take a look at the image, and you say, okay, here's what I'm going to do next. But it's a very simple, remote, completely devoid from the rest of the world because you're on a different time schedule and you are on a mountaintop with very few other people. You know, there's 3 or 4 other people doing, you know, telescope work also on the mountain, but they're each of them in their own telescope observatory. There's, you know, each in a different building. And so you really don't see each other during the night.
I'm sure you're familiar. Well, I know, you know, the Elijah on the mountaintop and God comes in the still. Is that it sounds a bit like that, Brother Guy, that you're up there in the beautiful stillness of the universe. And does it bring you closer to God, this work?
That is exactly right. Yes, that still small voice. And the data we look for is usually the still small quiet stuff.
Mm.
You know, people sometimes ask, what's the big exciting things you've discovered? And the exciting things aren't the big things. I mean, the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov put it that the most exciting thing you hear a scientist say is, "Aha, I found it," but rather, "Huh, that's funny."
Mm-hmm.
And it's being open to being surprised. That's the first step of discovery. And I'll draw the analogy with religion again, because that's really how it works. It's not showing spectacular acts of love, but it's taking the garbage out every day.
Absolutely. I've got another question. I'm running out of time, Brother Guy. I've got to keep up with these questions. Do you think a meteorite can ever destroy the Earth? I guess they've been watching that film, or the films where the meteorites crash, asteroids crash into the Earth. Is this likely, or is this total Hollywood?
Well, the Earth will survive. Whether we as human beings, that's a different question. It did happen, you know, 60 million years ago to the dinosaurs. And that's what happens when you don't have, when you're a dinosaur without a space program. It can happen. The odds are about 1 in 60 million that it'll happen this year. So, you know, if you're really worried about it, I'd say quit smoking and wear your seatbelt. That's much more important.
Probably. Brother Guy, very quickly, another question. Spend as little or as long as you want this, but we've got to go in a minute. What does Brother Guy think of UFOs? They're always in the news, to be fair to the questioner. Yeah.
The more you know about the sky, the fewer things that you see up there are unidentified. And, you know, with the invention of the cell phone, we've gotten marvelous pictures of things we never would have believed, but we haven't gotten any more marvelous pictures of UFOs. So it's fascinating. The only place in the world that people ever see UFOs is in North America. And I think that's just because we're the country that's least familiar with the sky. And so anything you see up there surprises you.
That's true, actually. And I live on a flight plan into Heathrow, and there's always something on the skies. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what it is. It's definitely unidentified. Listen, Brother Guy, I could speak to you for the rest of the morning, but unfortunately my producers have told me that the interview has to end. So listen, where can people find out more about you, your work, and the work of the Vatican Observatory?
We've got a website. It's vaticanobservatory.org. And you go there and you'll find a collection of, you know, hundreds of articles about faith and science. You'll find recent articles that members of the observatory and our friends write about what's going on in our lives. And it's just a great place to, you know, great website to wander around and find all sorts of fun things. Vatican Observatory, all one word, .org.
Wonderful. Brother Guy, when are you next at the top of the mountain? When do you next ascend?
They made me the director. My job is raising money so that other people can go up there now. So since I've been the director, I haven't been able to.
What a shame. Brother Guy, thank you so much for coming on. Please come back.
I should be delighted. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll be ascending the mountain to pray to the Lord in Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency.